Hi, my name is Roughhouse, along with Pete Havlin from Lone Star Spirits. Hi, Pete.
Hey, how's it going?
That's the part where you say, hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, how are you?
You just
have the cue cards over here.
There, you see, you jump in and you participate. That's how radio works, you see.
Oh, okay. I had to learn that.
All right. And joining us right now is Dr. Pam Heath. Hi, Pam. How are you doing?
I'm doing well today. How about yourself?
Living the dream, you know. Here in Florida, there's never a bad day. Okay. Unless it's you know, hurricane or fire or tornado or 12-foot alligator in the backyard.
I spent 7 years in Orlando. I liked it very much.
I was going to ask you about that. I was reading that you have ties to Central Florida.
Yeah. I used to go to Enterprise 1701, back when Frank Dower owned it, and really into science fiction and Central Florida, Casadega.
What'd you do? You went to Casadega. I've been there many times.
Yeah. I like Casadega.
Really? Because I've never gotten anything there, believe it or not.
Well, in terms of spirits, I don't know about that, but I actually spent some time learning from a spiritualist healer in Casadega. She charged y'all $4 a lesson. She was really in it for the money.
Yeah. Gee, who'd have thunk?
Oh, wow.
And it was an interesting place because about half the people there are real psychics and half of them are frauds.
Yeah, absolutely. For people who don't know, Casadega is a spiritualist camp, basically. The whole entire town consists of mediums and psychics and whatnot. And, we went there and we've had people.
Right, it's about a half hour up the road from Orlando.
Yeah, it's not too far, actually. It's basically as central of Florida as you can get, you know, Casadega is. But so what'd you do when you were here in Central Florida? What is it you did here?
I was an anesthesiologist.
Oh, okay.
It was during that time that I started having psychic experiences spontaneously and didn't know what the heck was going on. And I actually checked around and found the name of someone who sounded like a real psychic who was up in Casadega, and I went up to see him, and he was the real deal, which was nice for a first experience. And I did some training with his foster sister on healing and stuff, and I really enjoyed it. We did some old-fashioned physical science, this is before I got trained as a parapsychologist. I actually got to chase tables around the room, and we had all kinds of stuff actually happen.
You did not.
You
chased tables?
It was really cool. Chased a table around the room. Yeah, it was great. And another time, somebody was channeling, and I actually saw the outline of their head and face change. And they were, like, right next to me. So that was really neat. But I was, you know, it's something that other people don't know about, outsiders don't know about, because at the time, at least, I was the only non-professional medium who was there. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it for money, and they didn't have outsiders in. They just did it for their own amusement and entertainment. And I got invited because I was the student of one of the mediums.
Mm-hmm.
And so as her student, I got to attend some of these, and It was the real deal. It was not fraud. And I tell you, some wild stuff happened. So it was a great first experience, again, in some ways, before I went into parapsychology, because I know a lot of people who get degrees in parapsychology, especially if they train at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, are very cynical. And they get to the point where they think everything is fake and everything's a fraud. And because I was so well grounded, not only in my own personal experiences, but in seeing some things that were clearly real, that were clearly not faked, could not have been faked, and were not done for money or fame or anything else, I really like coming at parapsychology from that angle. So you end up being a situational skeptic where you don't know if something paranormal is occurring in a given situation, but you sure as heck know that the paranormal exists.
Absolutely. So that's where you got your start in the paranormal, was there at that point at Casadega?
Yeah. Yeah, it really was.
That's interesting stuff. I've had people that are in our group say that they had some really scary stuff happen at the Casadega Hotel there. Like I said, I've never experienced it myself, but if you say it's spooky, I'll believe you.
Well, I don't know how many ghosts there are. I mean, there's enough spirit, you know. I mean, most of the spirits I ran into were actually deceased relatives of the people who were there, or people who used to be in the camp, and it sort of hung out in spirit to help their successors.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like a negative haunting that I ran into at all.
Right.
And like I say, and about half the people there are fucked. And I did ask, you know, my teacher, why they allowed the frauds to stay. Because everybody knew who they were, at least if you were part of the inner circle. You knew who was real and you knew who was not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they said they felt that there should be someone for everyone. And some people needed a real read and some people didn't.
Oh, gosh.
And they'd be drawn to what they needed. And I thought, well, that's an interesting take.
I guess, you know, we could allow fake doctors in, too, because, you know, everybody needs somebody.
Well, there's a lot of, unfortunately, fake doctors out there, but...
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we won't go there.
No, I don't want to go there. And we have to deal with the hate mail again.
No.
But that's how I got my start, and then I spent a couple years on the Navajo Indian Reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I found out that parapsychology actually did exist as a field outside of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I was reading my PSP Hauntings and Poltergeists, which I think a lot of ghost hunters are familiar with, Lloyd Auerbach, and really a wonderful book, really got me into parapsychology, and I started searching out where you could study it. And at the time, there was one place in the United States where you could get a doctorate degree, and that was Rosebridge Graduate School of Integrative Studies.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that no longer exists.
Oh.
So pretty much you got to go to Europe or Scotland if you want to get a degree in parapsychology now.
Right. So you mentioned Lloyd Auerbach. What's your relationship with him these days?
I've worked with Lloyd since 1996, and we still do occasional haunting investigations together. We did one in Berkeley earlier this year, which was really interesting, a haunted hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of ghosts, a lot of different ghosts.
Really?
And also place memory and some other stuff going on with ley lines and a really interesting case.
Can you discuss place memory? You know, kind of what it is and so forth?
Yeah, place memory basically refers to the fact that the environment can act like a camcorder. And living people can imprint their emotions or events onto the environment, which people who are sensitive to it can then play back. So there's basically a couple different ways you can record place memory. One is if it's a really high emotional event, like murder, right? You see all the psychic detectives reading place memory. High emotional events can record well. And it doesn't have to be a negative emotion either. It can be a positive emotion. And I want to emphasize, it's recorded by the living. You don't have to be dead to record place memory. And if you're reading the place memory someone recorded, they may still be alive.
Hmm.
It's not a living ghost. It's just place memory. It's recorded by the living. But when I was in New Zealand, I ran into a night manager of a haunted hotel, and it's really funny. He didn't really believe in ghosts, but he believed in place memory because he had been going through, a few years back, a divorce. And he'd been really angry at the time. And then he sold the house, and the lady who bought the house turned it into sort of a halfway home. And one night she had a schizophrenic woman that she put up in the attic, and she came down the next morning. The woman hadn't slept in her bed at all, and she was still outside the house. And she asked her why, and she said, well, there's a man up in my room, you know, and she described him with his beard and stuff and said, and he keeps cursing and kicking the walls and, you know, explained everything he's doing. The woman who had bought the house from him told him the story, and he was like, oh, my God, that was him. Everything she described, it was how he looked at the time he was going through divorce, and it was what he was doing at the time of the divorce.
Wow.
So he was a big believer in place memory because he had done it.
So,
that's
interesting. Yeah. So if you're reading in place memory, don't assume it's a ghost. Maybe someone who's perfectly alive.
Well, Would that kind of coincide a little bit with, you know, some people mentioned residual hauntings? Would that kind
of? Yeah, I think residual hauntings is actually place memory. You know, most of the time. I know some people will also refer to a slightly different term, which is residual energy. Okay? And what they're trying to describe is if you have, it's an odd thing to feel, and parapsychologists don't really have a term for this, but as a psychic, I've experienced it, so I know what they're talking about. If you have a ghost that has recently been in a place, it hasn't really imprinted place memory, but it's like you can feel their wake, their energy wake. And so there's sort of a little residual energy from their passing. But it's not really imprinted into place memory. If you give it a little time, it disperses. But you can sort of sense they were recently through there.
Well, kind of like cycling out, kind of, the energy just dissipating and...
Yeah, if you think about if you have a boat that zooms by on a river, you have the wake behind it. And then if you wait a few minutes, the water just goes back to flat again. It's sort of like that. It's like you can feel the disturbance in the energy if they've recently passed through. But if you give it a little time, you know, you won't sense anything. It's just back to normal.
Right. Okay. So, you mentioned something about ley lines. What exactly is a ley line, and how does it affect paranormal research or mediumship, for that matter?
Well, I don't think parapsychologists have a good term for ley lines. We look for geomagnetic fields and things like that, which aren't necessarily what psychics refer to as ley lines. Psychics will refer to ley lines as sort of power lines that go throughout the planet, sort of a subtle energy grid that can be tapped into. At least that's what most people... But, you know, it's one of those soft terms that different people mean slightly different things by it, and you won't see parapsychologists refer to too often.
So how does being a psychic yourself help you personally... during investigations?
Well, I kind of bounce back and forth between being the scientist and being the psychic.
Right.
And I'll scan the room, I'll see what's there, I'll see what information I pick up. I'll also, you know, try to corroborate it with, you know, scientific equipment like geomagnetometers or more often a tri-field meter. But I've got to say, I think the longer I do this work, the less useful I'm finding equipment, and the more I'm starting just to rely on my senses.
Right, because I was watching a video that you have on your webpage with Chris Fleming, and you may be the first psychic medium person that I've seen that actually uses equipment. I mean, I thought that was unusual, and that's why I had to ask you. Which side do you sit on that fence?
I'm a parapsychologist. I did that show. I was supposed to be the parapsychologist. I wasn't supposed to be the psychic. So that was kind of an odd experience because I was being the scientist, but then I'd have to quickly, you know, tune in and see if I was getting what Chris was getting or not. And if he was on the right track or not, you know. And so I was sort of scooting back and forth mentally, which can be kind of stressful. Usually I will try to pick one role or the other to play. I'll either be the psychic or I'll be the parapsychologist. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about stuff that is not filmed, my own investigations, my work with Lloyd, for example, I'm doing both. I'm checking the equipment, but I'm also seeing what I can get psychically, and then I'll see if I can confirm it in other ways.
Right. What's your read on Chris Fleming? There's some people are really into him. Some people are skeptical of him. You've actually been with him. What's your read on him?
He's very sincere. I think there are times, like every psychic gets, where you're not sure where the information is coming from, and he'll admit this, that he doesn't know if the information is coming from who it purportedly comes from, if it's coming from a different spirit that's an imposter, if it's coming from a part of his unconscious. It's always hard to tell where the information is coming from precisely. But he is very sincere. He does not fake stuff himself.
Okay. So you think he's the real deal?
The times I worked with him. I don't always trust other people around him, but Chris is very sincere.
Yeah, that's a healthy thing to have, you know, not trusting some people, you know. Because, like you said, there at Casadega,
there's... We won't get into stories here.
Oh, we could. Please do.
No. But.
Okay, I'll let you off the hook there.
I try to be very careful, but of course you never know what's going to get edited out. And I know one of the things that annoyed me about the Alcatraz episode was the way they edited it, because they edited it out in a very disjointed way. So, for example, Chris actually got some accurate, what I thought was accurate place memory of Al Capone. They didn't show it. Instead, they showed some place memory was picking up from a totally different, very aggressive inmate, and they cut it to the scene in Al Capone's room as if that was what he got in Al Capone's room. I mean, there was some stuff like that that went on that was, like, really weird. And
well, they, you know, that they always cut in drama and stuff like that. And
yeah, but this didn't make any sense. I actually, the place memory he got was actually far more interesting than what they showed. I mean, I don't know. You just never know what the editor is going to see as a good way. And when I watched the episode, you know, it is disjointed in terms of what they show when and where and what they cut out. And to me, I would sometimes say the more interesting parts of the investigation are the ones that don't get shown. Because we were there for almost 12 hours.
Yeah.
And that's about maybe 15, 16 minutes of the show.
Wow. Well, all shows, TV shows, from what I understand, are like that. You know, from Ghost Hunters to Most Haunted to, you know, all of them. It's all down to the editing. You know, the people in the show have nothing to do with that. So.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Yes and no. The editors certainly control a lot. The producers, directors, and casters have influence in terms of the direction the show takes.
Mm-hmm.
And how much fakery is encouraged or even mandatory.
Mandatory? You're saying they're actually faking these shows? No. You're destroying it.
There are rumors, and I will not name networks or shows, where, for example, parapsychologists who are known to refuse to be involved in fakery have been blacklisted.
Yeah.
And will not be on those shows.
Oh wow.
So
yeah, I know some of those shows they really get into some, you know, set dressing and so forth to make it really eye appealing as well as action.
Oh well, you know, I think probably the most famous in
you can mention it. We've talked about them.
British shows where it's pretty well cat out of the bag sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, I can't say that. You have to be careful. There are some American shows that have been very sincere and are very real. And there are some parts of some American shows that I feel are very real. And there are others where I think they decide that this is entertainment. This is not really, I mean, you could tell you stories about reality TV. I mean, get away from the whole paranormal issue, how unreal reality TV is. And so you have to take it with a grain of salt. You have to understand they are marketing it as entertainment, not as science.
And that's
watch Ghost Stories, on the other hand, Fangoria TV. I know Garrett and Al, who are the co-hosts of that. Now, nothing there was fake. That's all real.
Yeah, I know that. I know for one that Al and Gary they wouldn't put up with that.
They're good guys. They're very good guys, and I've watched their episodes. And I've actually been to some of the places that they investigated, and they are haunted. I got a chance to be with them up at Cape May earlier this month, and it was a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
I went to a number of their places that they had investigated on TV, and yeah, there were ghosts. Lots of ghosts.
You know, I remember when I was out there in San Francisco when we went to that, we sat down, we did that, we founded Crow, and we went on the USS Lexington, right? I'm sorry, yeah. The Hornet.
The Hornet. You were with me on the Hornet.
Yeah, I was with you on the Hornet, and didn't you and I walk back to one specific barracks? I had a weird feeling about it, but Brad Feen brought me back here. I was kind of accurate, I thought, but I'm thinking.
Oh, that's a great place. You know, I try to be involved with them at least for the flashlight tours. We do once a month flashlight tours where we take people in parts of the ship not normally open to the public. And the Hornet is a wonderful place for many reasons, both because historically it's a very interesting ship that was built during World War II. Was a very lucky ship, was never actually hit by any bombs, but really, at one point, was like the only ship holding the line against the Japanese in the Pacific, or at least the only aircraft carrier, because the others were all damaged and had to go back for repairs. So it was out to sea for like 18 months. And very lucky ship, and a very happy ship in many ways, and it has hundreds, literally hundreds of spirits there who have come back, mostly because they enjoy the ship, and it sort of helped it become a museum. And they're very interactive. I mean, you see a lot of activity. Just recently, in the last month or so, garbage can lids have flown across the room, glass coffee pots have flown across the room. They've materialized in front of people. I got to see one in front of my eyes. That was wild. Because normally I just sort of see them psychically with my mind. This one I saw with my eyes in a flight suit getting into one of the helicopters. So very, very active place, but mostly very happy spirits. They very much are still a crew, and they have a chain of command. And they look at the people who work there regularly as volunteers as just being fellow crew members, and so they get along pretty well with us. And they seem to like women.
I'm sorry?
They like women.
Oh, I would imagine.
They sailors who like women.
So I always feel very well liked when I'm there. They can be very romantic guys. I've had my hand held, all kinds of things.
Wow. Who'd have thought sailors who like women?
I know. It's a great ship, and of course, a lot of the ghosts come back for the same reason as the docents do. They just love the ship. This was a great time in their life. Most of them didn't die on the ship. A lot of them didn't even serve on the Hornet, but they served on other ships, and they just come back and have a good time.
That's great.
Now, wasn't there a first Hornet, and then this was renamed? This was the second Hornet that was renamed.
More than that, there's been Hornets since the Revolutionary War.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. But basically what it was is in World War II, there was the Hornet CV-8, which was the predecessor for this Hornet, and it got sunk. And one of the things they did to sort of try and psych out the Japanese, who were superstitious, is they would rename ships. So they renamed, this was originally going to be the Kearsarge when they started building it in 1942. When the Hornet was sunk, they renamed it the Hornet in 1943. And then,
they got confused
because the Japanese would never name a ship the same name as one that had been killed.
Right.
So it's the Hornet CV-12 is what it was called. And, like I say, a very lucky ship, very proud ship. It has held all kinds of records. It was like one of the fastest until the nuclear submarines came along.
Interesting stuff. Well, shifting gears just real quick, what is the PK Zone?
The PK Zone was my first book, which was basically a more readable version of my dissertation, which was on mind over matter experiences, which we call psychokinesis, or PK. And the first third of the book looks at stories of PK from around the world since the dawn of time, since my since my teacher said that was a reasonable literature review to do. I'm like, you're crazy! And then the middle third of the book is the experimental research that had been done up until about 2000. And then the last third is what the experience is like for those who do it, and some sort of tips for how you might be able to get better at controlling PK and how it might sort of overlap with ESP experiences. And I will say, I'm actually working on rewriting this book. It will update the research till 2007, but it's also taking out almost all the quotes because copyright permissions are no longer what they were when I originally wrote this book. Mm-hmm. And so almost all the quotes are going to get paraphrased. So if people want the original quotes, you know, which is great if you're doing reference work and research, they need to get this old book before I pull it, and the new one is out later this year, because the new one will not have the quotes.
Where can they get the this version of it now?
Amazon.com is probably the easiest choice, or you can go to iUniverse.com. It's just called The PK Zone. It's under my name, Pamela Heath. Mm-hmm. And if they want to read more about it, people can go to my website at www.pamelaheath.com.
That's easy to remember.
Yeah. I have to say, though, I'm probably even more proud of my second book, which came out this last year, which is on suicide.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that one.
This is one that I co-wrote with John Klimo, who is the world's expert on channeling. And channeling is where mediums seem to get information from some source other than themselves. Hopefully from ghosts or whatever. And what we did with this book, it grew out, actually, this goes back to when I was a graduate student, too. And John Klimo was my dissertation chair and the faculty member I was supposed to always come to. And, you know, he'd sit in the office and listen to them talk. And he would tell me stories of how he was once assigned to gather some messages of suicides together for someone who was suicidal, because it was felt if people knew what they were getting into, they would make a different choice. And I always thought, man, that would be a great book. That would be a great book. John, you should write that book. John, write that book. He didn't want to do it.
So
he and I did it together. Basically, it's a literature review pulling from like 500 books, about a fourth of which had information about suicides or regarding suicides in the afterlife, what their experience is supposed to be like, what kind of adjustment problems they have, how they can be helped, what kind of messages they send back to the living. And we looked at three kinds of suicide, traditional suicide, assisted suicide, and suicide bombers, or suicide mass murder. And there was almost no information on the suicide mass murder. So we actually went to some mediums and asked them if they would try to channel suicide bombers. And most of the time they said no.
Gee, I wonder why.
So what we did, they didn't want to deal with these folks. They didn't want to feel their energy. So what we did is we said, how about if you channel the guides for suicide bombers? And they said, guides, okay. So what usually happened is they started by channeling the guides, and then as they got more comfortable with things, they started actually channeling some of the suicide bombers. And one of the more interesting ones that came through, if it is to be believed, was
right.
This was like 2 or 3 months after those Russian planes went down. These
right.
two women spirits came through claiming to have been on those planes that got downed as suicide bombers. And at the time we were doing this material, it was so new, and nobody knew anything about it. And it was just, you know, again, you don't know if these people who are who they claim they be, you know.
Right.
And you have to, you know, and we do in the book, you know, point out when we're like, I don't know if this is true or not, you know, take this with a grain of salt, but this is what they said. There's some very interesting stuff there, though.
You're listening to ParaHub Radio, the Internet's only rock and roll paranormal extravaganza. My name is Roughhouse. We're talking with parapsychologist Dr. Pam Heath, and we got more of her interview coming up in just a few minutes. Right now, though, we got to step away and check in with the news. Here's Paula Jedi.
ParaHub Radio News.
This is Paula Jedi with ParaHub Radio News. In Nepal, the statue of Hindu god Bhimeshwar has been sweating since Saturday, and Hindus are interpreting this as a bad omen. Although skeptics have dubbed the sweat as condensation, local priests insist that this type of thing happens just before a disaster or crisis in the royal family. The statue was reported as sweating just before an earthquake in 1934. I guess only time will tell. UFO sightings will most likely be increased in the UK soon. British police will now be using spy drones for finding public disorder and antisocial behavior. The remote-controlled flying spy drone will also be monitoring traffic and aiding in police investigations. These drones work in conjunction with GPS and also come in night vision modes. In Cape Coral, Florida this week, a dead man's ashes were stolen from a car and then were thrown all over the owner's lawn. Ashes belong to the father of 35-year-old Wayne Caraway, who believes the thief thought they were drugs in the box. Caraway said his father died in 1995, and he was just about to go spread the ashes over the Everglades. He still plans to do just that, as he and his wife have already dug up the remains from the ground. A 60-year-old grandma in Trenton, New Jersey, just gave birth to twin boys on Tuesday via C-section, each boy weighing in at 4 pounds 11 ounces. Officials believe she may very well be the oldest woman to give birth to twins in the United States. The woman received in vitro fertilization to conceive the babies in South America and has been married for 38. Poltergeist Tower is bigger than ever, and now your portal to the unknown has a new home. Write it down, bookmark it, and visit it every day. www.poltergeisttower.com. That's with two T's. The Internet's most awesome paranormal forum is at Poltergeist Tower, your portal to the unknown. In rock news, Dave Mustaine of Megadeth has just announced that there will not be another Gigantour until 2008. Megadeth plans to play in Europe next month, and they say they just don't have enough time for Gigantour this year. They are also celebrating the recent release of their latest album, United Abominations. Korn and Linkin Park, along with other bands, performed at the Weenie Roast concert in Irvine, California on Saturday. The band lineup included artists that had new material about to be released. The type of music performed included a mix of rock, Latin, whistling, and more. Rock bands that played included Queens of the Stone Age, The Killers, and 30 Seconds to Mars. Approximately 16,000 people were watching this concert. Smashing Pumpkins crashed several ticket sales servers on Sunday when their tickets for their Asheville, North Carolina concert went on sale. Apparently, so many people logged into the ticket web servers that it crashed and halted the sales. The Pumpkins also have a new song out called Tarantula, which you can hear at spinner.com. The Zeitgeist album will be released on July 10th. Velvet Revolver and the Remains of Alice in Chains will be touring in the U.S. and Canada this summer, running from August to October. Although there is no opening band yet scheduled for the first leg of the tour, a band called Sparta from Texas will be opening during the second leg. From the Internet's only rock and roll paranormal extravaganza, this is Paula Jedi on ParaHub Radio, the center of the paranormal universe.
Can you imagine a world without children? A world without their smiles or their laughter? A world where children don't play, or sing, or dream, or imagine.
At St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, we can't imagine a world without children. That's why we're working every day to find cures for diseases that strike down children everywhere. Diseases like cancer, pediatric AIDS, and sickle cell. And we won't stop until every child is cured and every disease is defeated. Because we can't imagine a world without children. Can you?
Finding cures, saving children. St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. To learn how you can help, call 1-800-931-0800 or log on to our website, stjude.org.
news stories.
October 27th, I was lying in my bed and I saw a blue ball light outside my window.
And untold events.
And then things just started falling off of the shelf.
Parahub Radio.
On the Parahub Radio Network.
You're listening to Parahub Radio, the internet's only rock and roll paranormal extravaganza, heard exclusively on the Parahub Radio Network. I'm Rough House, along with Pete Haviland, talking with Dr. Pam Heath, a parapsychologist right now. Earlier tonight, we spoke with another psychic, Barb Powell, who's in Saskatchewan, and she was telling us about what she does is, and she works with the police a lot on cases. Mm-hmm. So call her up. Do you ever get that kind of stuff?
No, I don't. I actually try not to work much as a psychic. Mm-hmm. I did for a while just to sort of develop my abilities, do phone reads, and I still do tarot for friends and things like that. But for the most part, I try to play the parapsychologist more, and I use my psychic abilities to help me be a better parapsychologist rather than my parapsychology knowledge to help me be a better psychic.
But yet you're finding yourself not using the tools to do parapsychology.
Not as much. You know, part of it is I think I'm PKing. I'm affecting the equipment.
Oh.
If I touch a tri-field meter, it's like it dies, you know, which sort of kills you. I can't get within 12 feet sometimes of a natural tri-field meter, or I set it off. Human beings aren't supposed to do that.
Yeah, that's what Lloyd was talking about when we spoke to him, is that you tend to play hell on a tri-field, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, so I'm finding that it's sort of frustrating. I'm finding I am relying less on equipment, partly because I don't have a choice, and partly I'm just getting more and more information on my own that I'm finding useful. And, of course, the question is, what is your purpose in doing the investigation? For me, it's not proving that the afterlife exists. I'm not about proof. I don't think you can prove this to anybody, you know, who hasn't experienced it for themselves firsthand. I'm about trying to help people, both living and dead. I try to help the living understand what's going on and cope with it, and I try to help the dead if they need to move on. In rare cases, if the dead are actively harming or threatening to harm the living, I will force the issue in terms of moving them on.
Mm-hmm. And how would you go about doing something like that, if you can share that?
Well, I talk about how you can move spirits under the light on my website and have a MP3 if people want to listen to it, as well as a written talk. There's all kinds of different ways you can do it, and you don't have to be staid or boring about it. You can get very creative and have a lot of fun. For most people, you try to entice them to the light. You try to encourage them. You think of what is it that would make them comfortable. You know, are there friends who can come back from the light and help them move on? Are they someone who's Catholic and didn't get last rites? So you have a Catholic spirit come, you know, priest spirit come from the light, give them absolution, last rites, so that they feel comfortable moving on. What does it take to make them feel comfortable to move on? If they absolutely, and this is very rare, that I feel that they are harming themselves and others, you know, with their behavior, I will surround them with white light and move them on.
Oh, okay. All right. And can you describe a little bit about poltergeist activity?
Poltergeist activity, most people feel, is human mind over matter. And sometimes you have it also in haunting situations where the ghost isn't the one doing it. It's human beings who are so stressed out by the ghost that they're causing stuff to fly around the room. I think where you see a lot of poltergeist activity is where you have stress, where there's not a better outlet for it. And the mind uses its ability to release stress by acting on the environment.
Okay.
And it can be, you know, if you're doing a poltergeist investigation, you get to play newspaper reporter. You look at the who, what, when, where, you know, and that helps you understand the why this is happening.
Right.
And it, you know, but you'll also see this kind of activity, and I talk about this a lot in the PK zone. it can be something that we all do. The spoon bending is something 85% of people can certainly do. I've done spoon bending. It's very easy. I also blow light bulbs, so if I'm angry, so I have to be careful. If I'm really upset, not to touch any light switches, or that bulb is history. So
I won't get you mad, I promise.
It's very, most of the time it's human PK. Once in a while, ghosts can do it, but it's usually not any more common for them than it is for human beings.
Okay.
You know?
And how common is, okay, I know that what you're describing on some of the poltergeist activity is external. Can poltergeist activity be internal as well?
Well, are you talking about...
biting poltergeists or choking poltergeists and so forth?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Lloyd's done cases where it was very clear a person was causing self-injury. And in fact, very, very common. A lot of people who do poltergeist activity may have poor self-esteem or issues where they end up turning against themselves. And I got to say, you don't have to be doing poltergeist activity to be doing things against yourself. I mean, you can even look at people who deal with stress and get hypertension and heart disease, or you can look at people who take it to more extremes and they cut on themselves. But, yeah, a lot of the so-called biting, scratching poltergeist, the agent is the person who is being injured. And then what's sort of interesting is most poltergeist cases, people who are not the agent are seldom injured. So you might have a rock, like, flying straight at somebody, and at the last second it slows down and then gently taps them. That's pretty typical for poltergeist violence. It's usually not that violent unless it's being perpetrated against the poltergeist agent themselves.
Have you experienced that kind of activity yourself?
I blow light bulbs if I'm angry.
Yeah,
that's sort of my I know Lloyd, when he's stressed, he starts to bend, metal starts to bend, and of course, he can be very hard on computers. I know Lynn Buchanan, who's a remote viewer, is good at killing computers and has done some other poltergeist-type activity. So,
well, maybe I might have
common
something.
Thing. Yeah, I think it happens a lot more than most people realize. It's just they don't realize that they are doing it, and they attribute it to something else.
A lot of the
objects flying during Ouija board experiments, a lot of those are not caused by ghosts. They're caused by freaked out teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, human beings.
Right. It's quite possible that I may be developing something, because this past week I have killed a computer, a car, and I'm slowly working on some... a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
I suppose.
I recommend trying to find a better outlet for it. If, again, to go to my website, I have a little thing about spoon bending or spinning an energy wheel. See if you can start doing more healthy things.
Yeah, I thought you were going to tell me to find a happy place.
They got one poltergeist agent who was a bartender had to levitate pretzels and turn them upside down on obnoxious clients. So, I mean, you can make it do fun things, too. You don't have to do things that are negative or stressful.
Right.
What is your thoughts on there's kind of a movement going on right now that some people think that using scientific equipment going in on a haunting is more beneficial than bringing it in either the human aspect of like parapsychology or using the person that themselves that have experienced something and they kind of like taking that away. I mean, what do you think about that as far as investigations and so forth?
I don't think you can take away the human element. You know, fundamentally, hauntings are a human subjective experience. And so you really need to get the witnesses' stories. It's wonderful, and I recommend for everybody to try to use scientific equipment to confirm things. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you cannot take away the subjective component of it, because it is a subjective experience.
Okay.
All right. Well, here's my questions. Recipes? Seahorses? What's going on in the world of Dr. Pam Heath?
I'm into a lot of different stuff, you know, art and cartooning. And but I would say right now, I guess I'm more concerned than anything else about kind of getting the word out to those who might be thinking of taking their own lives that it's not a good choice, in the sense that almost nobody who did it came back and said that they got what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying, you know, that they're going to be damned or they're going to burn or anything else. Everybody's forgiven. Everybody moves on. But it doesn't get you what you want. You know, it really doesn't get you what you want. And by and large, people found themselves struggling with worse things than when they were alive. So the message kind of that they come back and tell the living is, don't do what we did. It really is a mistake. You're better off sticking it out through life and doing your best.
Right.
And the message they send back to those left behind is, we are okay. You know, we still love you. There's still a bond. And, you know, forgive yourselves for any guilt or anger you might have over the fact we did this. Because, I tell you, it's devastating to those left behind.
Right. Are you familiar with the Robin Williams movie, What Dreams May Become?
I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like that, is what you're saying.
Well, it is and it isn't. That was a self-created hell.
Right.
And that's the problem. A lot of these people create their own hell. And it can be very hard to get through to them. And in fact, sometimes it takes the living to be able to get through to them because they're so sure they're not dead and they're still trying to kill themselves over and over again that it's only someone who's alive that they're willing to see.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, we all create our own realities all the time. We have either rose-colored glasses or we may see everything in a negative way or whatever. But at least in the real world, somebody can come up and shake us by the shoulder and say, hey, you know, come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one who can do that in the spirit realm. You have no eyes that can see. You have no body that can be touched. You have only your mind, your consciousness, and it perceives what it wants to perceive, and it can block out anything it wants to block out.
Right.
And so if you have spirit helpers, and they say there's always spirit helpers that are trying to help you, but you can ignore them completely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where sometimes living mediums actually are useful to be able to get through because they're willing to see people who are alive.
Right.
So they can get you can get through to them sometimes. And also, if people want to know how they can help the dead, prayer seems to help a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to get in contact with you, the best place, I guess, is your website?
www.pamelaheath.com. And I'll mention my co-author also has a website, www.jonklimo.com.
There you go. Dr. Pam Heath, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right, you guys will have to come on the Hornet sometime.
You know, I had wanted to go out to the West Coast for the longest time. I'm in Florida, so it's a long haul for me. But there's just so much out there to see.
Yeah, and we have a lot of haunted places out here for sure.
Right.
I know Florida does too. You know, I went through some number of them, but you got to come out and see the Hornet. The ghosts, they're always there. There's always a lot of them, and they're friendly. They like to play with people sometimes.
I'll have to put that on my list of things to do before I go.
All right.
Yeah, that place was really cool when I went there.
Cool.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a great place.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again.
It was my pleasure. Take care.